Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the February NJEDA board meeting. At this time, all phone participants are in a listen-only mode. Please be advised today's meeting is being recorded. When the chairman opens the public comment portion of the meeting, members of the public attending by phone will be advised to press 1 and then 0 on your telephone keypad to be placed in the queue and speak or provide comment. You will be asked to provide your name and any organization with which you are affiliated. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. If you should require assistance during the call, please press star and then 0. I would now like to turn the conference over to Chairman Terry O'Toole. Please go ahead.
Thank you, operator. I'd like to call the meeting to order. Tim, could you read the open public meeting notice, please?
In accordance with the Open Public Meeting Act, notice this meeting has been sent to the Star Ledger and the Times of Trend at least 48 hours prior to this meeting. Any meeting notice has been posted on the Secretary of State's bulletin board at the Department of State.
Thank you, Tim. Manieri, could you call the roll, please?
Yes. Chairman
Terrence
O'Toole.
Present.
Vice Chair Charles Farlow.
Here.
Phil Elagia.
Here.
Virginia Bauer.
Here.
Fred Dumont.
Here.
Raphael Ferrara.
Here.
Jewel Antoine Johnson.
Here.
Marcia Morley. Robert Shimko.
Here.
Aaron Cruz from the executive branch.
Here.
Aaron Binder for State Treasurer Elizabeth Moyo.
Here.
Chief White, I'm sorry, Elizabeth Dragon for Commissioner Sean Lasserette.
Yes.
Chief White for Justin Zimmerman. I'm sorry, Commissioner Robert Angelo.
You got the real thing from the department there.
Yes, Keith Sear.
Yes. Commissioner Justin Zimmerman.
Present.
Mr. Chairman, we have a quorum.
Thank you, Manieri. There are two sets of meeting minutes for approval today. The first is are the minutes from the December 14th NJEDA board meeting for review and approval. I kindly request board members state their name for the record when making a motion or a second. Could I hear a motion to approve the December 14th board meeting minutes?
Jenny Bauer, I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. A second, please.
Second, Cruz.
Thank you. Any discussions? Hearing none, could I proceed to a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the board meeting minutes are approved. Secondly, from the board meeting on December 14th, we have executive session meeting minutes, which are included in your package. Could I hear a motion to approve the December 14th executive session meeting minutes?
So moved, Sarlo.
Thank you. A second, please.
Second, Oraja.
Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none, can we proceed to a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the meeting minutes are approved. Let me proceed to the chairman's remarks. First of all, I want to welcome our board today. We have a great turnout. We may need a larger board table if this continues, but thank you all for being here in person. I think, you know, we've tried post-COVID to bring the board back in person, and it's really great to see everybody showing up today. This is our first board meeting of the new year. We did not have one in January. And while all board meetings are important, today is particularly important because this is the beginning of a very important milestone for the NJEDA. In 2024, the authority will celebrate its 50th anniversary. On August 7, 1974, Governor Brendan Byrne signed Assemblyman Herbert Klein's bill into law, legislation that would authorize the creation of an authority charged with creating jobs for the working men and women of New Jersey by attracting new industry to and expanding existing industry within the state. 50 years and 10 governors later, our mandate remains similar, but our mission and programmatic reach have evolved and expanded significantly. Over time, the NJEDA has grown and adapted to the ever-changing economy, and learned that economic development is not a one-size-fits-all model. And in the face of adversity, NJEDA staff has continually risen to the occasion. In times of crisis, such as Superstorm Sandy or the COVID-19 pandemic, the NJEDA has been a model of responsiveness and agility. Under the leadership of Governor Phil Murphy, the role of the NJEDA has expanded significantly in order to support this administration's holistic view of economic development as a means of achieving the governor's vision for a stronger, fairer New Jersey economy. And achieving that vision hinges on the recognition that equity and inclusiveness need to be at the forefront of everything we do. Time and time again, Governor Murphy and the legislature have entrusted the NJEDA with developing and executing on resources that respond to the needs of New Jersey businesses and proactively foster the growth of industries and development projects that can deliver on the promise of Governor Murphy's Economic Development Strategic Plan by creating new jobs, driving economic activity, and revitalizing communities. Under this administration, the NJEDA has created a vast array of innovative, thoughtful resources that can be adapted to the needs of New Jersey entrepreneurs, small businesses, municipalities, and developers. From cannabis grants to historic preservation tax credits, offshore wind workforce development, income replacement for entrepreneurs, new ways to help Main Street businesses grow, and the attraction of high-profile film projects, this evolved version of the NJEDA is listened to and acted on the demands of the state's business community. And so far, that approach has shown measurable success. At the end of 2022, the NJEDA had an 11-fold increase in the number of businesses supported annually since the start of the Murphy administration in 2018, a staggering result by any measure. As we work to create opportunities for New Jerseyans from all backgrounds and foster the growth of New Jersey's economy during 2024, we will continue to celebrate 50 years of the hard work and achievements of the past and present. And we thank the NJEDA staff and leadership for guiding us in this effort. With that, I'll turn it over to Tim for the CEO's report.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really appreciate those remarks and the kind words about the EDA and its mission, and none of that is possible without the leadership of our chair and our board and, of course, the governor and the entire administration, and not just this governor, but 10 or 11 governors in the last 50 years as well. So it's a milestone year for us, a market with great progress and great success along the path we've been on, and we have a lot of work to do. There's a lot of work to do in this meeting, so I'll try and be brief, although a few things I want to cover. You have my written report. I won't go through it line by line. I would note, as the chairman mentioned, the note on inclusivity and equity, it's Black History Month, as we are one week or so into Black History Month. Always a good reminder and an opportunity to kind of renew our commitment to inclusion and diversity and equity in who we are as an organization and who we put on the field every day to go do this work, but also how we think about structuring our programs and who we're trying to serve and how we're trying to be a better, stronger, fairer organization in serving all of New Jersey. And you'll hear some of those themes come up during the programs today, thinking about things like small business and trying to broaden food security and trying to think about how we think about entrepreneurship in a much more inclusive and intentional way. And so it's a good reminder as we spend this month in Black History Month and as we think throughout the year about equity and inclusion is central and vital to everything that we do. It's been a while since we were together. There's a lot of news I could run through. Hopefully you've seen a lot of it. But a couple really big milestones. I'll start with the most recent one. On Sunday afternoon, if you heard an eruption of celebration from somewhere in the greater East Rutherford area, that was Phil and Tammy Murphy and a huge cohort of people celebrating the selection by FIFA of New Jersey, New York. I'm not calling it New Jersey, New York.
It's in New Jersey.
To host the finals of the World Cup. So a milestone moment at the result of tremendous effort led by the governor and the first lady in the front office and CHU New Jersey, and in fairness, the mayor's office in New York City and lots of other folks in New York. New Jersey in the Meadowlands on the world stage, something like 10 times the number of people watch the World Cup finals, watch the Super Bowl. It's a big deal, a lot of work to do, and there's a lot of things between here and now and then that need to happen to get ready for that, but just an extraordinary moment for New Jersey and for the region, and we'll have a huge economic impact. I think the estimates are $2 billion of economic impact to the region, billion with a B. So a really, really strong way to start the week and a really good evidence of our momentum broadly speaking. Other things I'd highlight, in December, the governor, 7 days apart, made two really extraordinary innovation economy-related announcements. The first was that Nokia Bell Labs is going to relocate and recommit to New Jersey and move to New Brunswick, and the second building of the Helix. Just an extraordinary thing. I think, you know, I've said this in public, risk of repeating myself. I think when we started the journey on thinking about the innovation economy, you thought about big institutional players that you could hope to get to do something. You'd say, and it'd be great if you can get, like, big academic medical centers and one or two academic institutions in the state to build something right by transit and do something interesting around the innovation economy. That'd be cool. It'd be great if you can get someone like Bell Labs to, like, do something. Well, even better, Bell Labs itself is going to relocate, double down, and recommit to New Jersey and do that at the Helix in New Brunswick, across the street from Rutgers, across the street from J&J. Just an extraordinary moment for the innovation economy. And then travel down Route 1 a few miles, and then the next Monday, Governor Murphy and the president of Princeton were together announcing a really big stake in the ground and sort of flag planting around artificial intelligence at Princeton. It's a big deal when an institution of Princeton's caliber and resources and reputation commits to something this deep of an engagement in the real economy. It speaks to the governor's vision for New Jersey to be a leader in artificial intelligence. If you watched or listened to the State of the State address, you probably heard more about AI than any other single topic. I think that's because the governor correctly realizes this is a big deal, not just for the economy, but for all of us as residents and citizens and humans. And managing through that change and harnessing the opportunities presented by AI is, we think, as, you know, the governor thinks most importantly, just an extraordinary opportunity for New Jersey. One other really good news item was a couple weeks ago, the board of the BPU voted to approve and award two new really big offshore wind projects, one to a group called Invenergy, a project called Leading Light, and others to Attentive, together about 3.5 gigawatts of power. We're not out of the woods yet on the challenges on offshore wind by any stretch of the imagination, but we are certainly back on our front foot. Those are two really strong projects that are both committed to use the wind port at their marshalling. They've both committed to supporting a tower manufacturer at the wind port. They've committed to support EW in Paulsboro, which is the only domestic manufacturing facility for offshore wind in America today still. And so, you know, those are long-term projects. That is not, you know, that is not fill the gap that was left behind by the disappointing news in the fall from Worstead, but certainly an indication of the long-term viability and momentum, not just in New Jersey, but in American offshore wind. So, again, a really good, positive set of news there. We also had, and it's, you know, obviously listed in the report, you know, we continue to push forward on lots of different fronts as well, including food security. We had the first approval for the really innovative fridge program that's going to be in Newark, where we'll bring more food to people who face food insecurity and live in food desert communities. We will launch next week the application for the second round of manufacturing voucher program. So a lot going on lots of fronts. And incredibly appreciative of the work of our team and the support of this board. You have also two dashboards, not one, but two dashboards, even one for January, essentially, as if we had a January meeting, which is the full year 2023 dashboard, and then the 1 month of 2024. We didn't have a board meeting in January, so the approvals numbers are a little less than they might be in otherwise in a regular month, but you can see through the full year of 23, there's an extraordinary amount of activity across a variety of programs. I won't go through them in detail, and even into the new year. I did want to take a moment before I'm going to hand it to Bruce. We often have a program update where someone will come and tell you, you know, about a program that we have kicking around and how it's doing and what's going on, just as a way to keep everybody current. I've asked Bruce to, or Bruce got this back row for some reason. Bruce is going to walk us through something that's not a headline grabber and not a program that we put out a press release saying, hey, we've got money to do something, but really important as we think about our obligations to be stewards of taxpayer resources and how we do tax credit compliance, a new technology platform that we've rolled out or are rolling out. So I'll give it to Bruce in a moment. But I do want to take a moment. This is like me having an open public meeting where I get to write a letter to the editor and I get to talk for a couple minutes. You know, you open the newspaper or you, God forbid, go on social media and you see all kinds of opinions that are floated around about narratives about New Jersey, particularly around the economy. Or you might encounter a survey that is conducted by a moving van company or U-Haul or something. I don't know who the hell does it, but would be methodologically classified as not statistically significant, but it gets lots of headlines anyway about moving vans or something. And Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but they're not entitled to their own facts. So I thought I'd just take a minute, point of personal privilege, as they say in the Roberts Rules, just to give you a quick refresh on some New Jersey economic facts. And these aren't my opinions. These aren't made up numbers. These are third party, mostly government sources of data. Next slide, please. So the broadly, and I'm not going to go through this in great detail and number by number, but we're adding jobs. The population is growing. The number of new small businesses is growing. The economy is growing as a GDP matter. Household income is growing. Housing values are growing like crazy. Anywhere, any major indicator you look at, things are moving in the right direction. Which is not to say we don't have real challenges. We don't have yawning inequality that still needs to be addressed. We don't have real challenges, particularly for small businesses. And, you know, you'd love to see all those numbers growing more and adding more. Right? Fine. Great. Got it. But things are moving in the right direction, not the wrong direction. Narratives about businesses fleeing. Yes, of course, some businesses close, some businesses leave. More are coming here and growing. People come and go. People move. It's a big economy. It's a big world. They move houses. More people are moving in than moving out. More people are having more children. I don't know exactly how the population growth numbers work, but there's more people who live here now than before. I'm going to go through a couple slides just to show you this real quick. Jobs. 4.37 million jobs in the private sector, in the economy. That's up from 4.18 in 2018. With a big dip in the middle where COVID, you know, sent a bunch of people home from work and lost a lot of jobs. We've added nearly 200,000 jobs net since 2018 and almost 400,000, almost 500,000 since the depths of the pandemic. So jobs are up. Next slide, please. Population is up. Used to be 8.9, now it's 9.3. Year over year, any number, you know, those numbers wobble a little bit. People come and go, but the number's up. Lots of states, that number is down. We did the congressional redistricting. A lot of states lost, in the Northeast lost congressional members. We have steady. Right? Population's growing. There are more small businesses than ever before. This is Rob's data. This is worksite data. There are 319,000 small businesses. I believe this is classified as 20 and under for these purposes. It used to be 258,000. Now it's 320,000. Up. Not to say there's not real challenges. Those small businesses face all kinds of challenges, mostly from big businesses. But there are more small businesses than before. Next slide, please. GDP is up. GDP is not my favorite indicator because it tells you how the economy is doing, not how people are doing. But GDP is growing. It's grown every year since the pandemic. It's growing at or around the national average. The economy is growing. We've added $53 billion in GDP. Next slide, please. Household income's up. Average household income, median household income is about $92,000, one of the highest in the country, up from $74,000 in 2018. And that's in current dollars, by the way. Household income is up quite a bit. And last thing, house prices. If you owned or bought a house in New Jersey in 2018, you've done pretty well. You've had not just a preservation of value, but it's gone up. States don't have stock prices, but housing prices is a pretty good proxy for how people think you're doing. There's strong demand, not enough supply. We need to build more. This is actually a problem. This one is actually a problem. This is leading to an affordability crunch. But it's because there's lots of demand. People want to be here. People want to be part of the story. These are facts. I didn't make them up. So when you hear non-factual assertions of things moving in the wrong direction, I encourage you to point to these facts. And by the way, I would assert, this is an opinion, these things are true not despite the things we've done around treating workers the right way and all the work that Rob and his team lead. It's about, caring about the environment, caring about equity and inclusion, caring about all the things that this administration cares about. It's not despite those things. It's because of them. We live in a talent economy. People are mobile. They can work anywhere, even more so now than they used to. So things like paid family leave and a fair minimum wage and all those things make people want to be here. And when they want to be here, they buy houses and it drives prices up. They have jobs that drive the economy. So things are not perfect. This is not mission accomplished. There's no banner coming down behind me on the battleship back here. We have work to do, tons of work to do. There's absolutely huge challenges ahead of us, but don't let anybody tell you that the big indicators move in the wrong direction because they're wrong.
I mean, one of the things, Tim, we should, you know, as we celebrate the 50th anniversary mm-hmm. this year, we got to tell this story, right? Because it just feels to me like people don't, as you say, as I, you know, talk to my friends, any of whom are, you know, sort of retired and, mm-hmm. you know, and you get the story, everybody's leaving the state and all the wealth is leaving the state, and somehow we just have to tell the story. Because,
yep.
as you said, the facts are the facts.
So with that, I'm going to yield the floor to Bruce. Unless comments, questions, reaction.
Just a quick comment. A great presentation. I just want to echo what you said. When you go to the small businesses slide, if you had broken it down to 5 employees or less, that growth is 35% in the past 5 years. So the typical mom and pop shops have had unbelievable growth. And I tie that to your early remarks that we served 11 times more businesses in this state than when we first got here. That is directly correlated. And you talked about small businesses, one of the challenges being large businesses. and talk about mandatory family leave, higher minimum wages. All these things are doing not just to protect workers, they give small businesses the same shot at that talent as large businesses because they can offer those same benefits and be on a level playing field. So just so appreciative of the partnership with the EDA on all of this efforts.
Great. With that, I'm going to yield the floor to Bruce while he's coming up. We spent a lot of our time in 2018, 19, and 20 talking about things like tax credit compliance and making sure we were doing the right things as stewards of taxpayer dollars, particularly around some of the legacy programs. One of the principles of that effort, and Bruce deserves a medal and all kinds of things, as Lisa Petrizzi, I don't know if she's here, but lots of folks who have gotten our arms around how to do that as well as we can and as well as we do it today. One of the principles of that effort was folks who have done the right thing, created the jobs they said they were going to create, made the investments that they were going to make, it should be pretty easy to comply. It should, make, you know, we should, it should be straightforward and not a torture to comply with our process. Not that it was a torture per se. Sorry, Bruce. I saw your chagrin. It wasn't a torture per se, but it wasn't as easy as it.
You put them through a lot, no doubt about it.
And it, as scrutiny is fair, but getting the data, getting the information, it shouldn't be, you know, punch cards and, you know, letters in the mail. Make it as easy as possible for the folks who have done what they said they were going to do to comply. So Bruce and his team and Tom Murphy and the IT team, with the support of this board, because you approved the funding to do it, have built a brand new system to make this better.
Sure.
And this is, again, this is the unsexy stuff that's important to what we do, because if we screw this stuff up, we lose the right to do all the things we talk about when we're talking about programs and investments and all that. So Bruce.
Awesome. All right, so I guess the first thing we'll do is kind of explain what the legacy IDMS is. So it's an instead of data management system. So as Tim said, all of the big jobs programs that are approved here at the board, they come to the back end, and that's where when you see those great pictures and you're like, oh, it's going to look very nice for this and it's going to look really nice there, we have to make sure that what they said they did, they actually did, which includes also the jobs component of that. So this IDMS system, which is the Incentive Data Management System, was created in 2010 for the BEEP program. And really, that was a job-based program to get employees to come to the state. But really, the program or the system itself was just a data repository. You guys upload stuff, we'll have it in a secure portal, we'll download it. That evolved as Bragg came on and Hub came on, and then our biggest one, Grow, came on. And then it became, well, we have to modify this system and have it where the job data can be put in and we can then analyze it. In 2019, when the reports came out of, you know, certifications not necessarily being the right way to look at job reports, we then took that system and said, all right, how can we analyze the job data better? And we did this with a partnership with the commissioner at Labor. There was no way we would have done this without that partnership. We are able to get that WR30 data, which allows us to cross-reference what applicants are telling us versus what they're actually reporting to the state. But in saying that,
WR30
basically a WR30 is the state form for federal the unemployment and for
Wage records
but they use it for unemployment and for disability insurance purposes when they're looking at somebody's wages, how much they would get in their for those two things.
So we're matching what the employer tells the state from a tax standpoint with what they're telling us from a job standpoint.
Correct. The caveat to that is WR30 is a quarterly report. We ask for our information monthly because it's a monthly average over time. So it adds to the complexity, which is why we needed a new system. This system that was built in 2010 as a data repository gets over 300,000 job entries a year and over 1,500 documents uploaded. It was time for something new, which is why we came here in May of 2023 and partnered with Microsoft to do that. We then came back in November for a little bit more money, and now we're coming to the end of the phase one of our engagement on the Microsoft system. So if you go to the next slide, we'll talk about what the next-gen improvements. So the biggest thing is security. Our other system, there was, what would happen is a company would log in and then either their consultant or whomever it would be that would be filling out the information would upload the documents and fill out the forms. We really didn't know who was actually doing the information. We knew it was the company because we provided the company with the username and login, but they could have shared it across multiple people. Now they will have their own username. They will have, we'll have our audit log to make sure we know exactly who is doing it. Functionality. What will happen, and we're going to show a slide later on in this process of what it will look like, But now a consultant that might have 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 companies that they're trying to help out, they'll have a list when they log in as a dashboard that says, here's all my companies, here's all my projects, and here's all my statuses. We're going to have a little bit more transparency in that they will know exactly where they stand in our process. So is it under EDA review? Is it sent back for questions to the company? And they'll be able to log directly into the portal right away to see exactly where they sit. It's a cleaner UI UX interface. It just looks nicer. It was built in 2010. It looks like it was built in 2010 back then. Now it looks like it's almost in the, 2021-ish time frame, even though we're in 2024. We can only go so far.
Good enough for government work.
Good enough. Listen, it looks nice. And then integration with CRM. So CRM is our client relationship management program. It's based on Microsoft Dynamics 365. It will now directly talk to our CRM system. So the moment they upload a document, the moment they upload a job report or whatever it might be, it will immediately feed into our back-end system so we can see that information right away. And we'll have dashboards to track and things of that nature. So that's what we got in this first phase. The next phase of what this next-gen improvement will be the matching piece. So now we need to take John Smith and match them to what DOL has. But DOL might have Jonathan Smith, right? So that creates a problem for us. So we talk about AI and try to utilize those functionalities. That's the next step that we're taking right now, embarking on. And this really is the torture that the company goes through. And I use the word torture because it's hard for the company, right? They have thousands and thousands of employees in the state, and we're trying to cross-reference that. They might have 10,000 employees, and we're trying to find the 1,000 that they put on our job log. And there's just a lot. There's a lot there, and we need to make this better. But we also need to improve our time that we get these tax credits out, as well as just, the staff that I have. We talk about goals every year. One of the goals I say to them is just show up for work tomorrow because it's tough. They have a lot they have to look at, and sometimes they're on the end of, we need to do it quicker. We need to do it faster. But they are steadfast that we're going to make sure that we are getting the jobs and the companies are doing what they said they're going to do. So this next phase really should help that. The other thing I always tell them, they'll have Mai Tais at noon one day, right? They'll be done their job by noon, get Mai Tais at noon, and be happy about it. I haven't delivered on that in the last 6 years of doing this. But, one day we'll get there. It is a beautiful dream.
Make sure it's working right.
All right, absolutely. If we can get there, everyone's invited. We can go to the next slide. So this is, when I talked about what it looks like now, this is what the new portal will look like. That is a picture of the State House. I gave this slide to somebody else before. I literally took, different variations of the State House because it looked so pretty in that picture right there. I was like, wait a second, I've seen it behind, walls for the last 3 years. I got to make sure that's what it looks like. But that is, in fact, our State House there in the background. But this is just kind of what it looks like, what an applicant will log into. If you go to the next screen, this will get into the project piece that I was referencing. So a consultant now will be able to have a dashboard of looking at all their projects. All this is test data, so there's nothing in there that is real. But this just makes it nicer for everyone who has multiple projects to be able to see where exactly each of their annual reports are. And then the next screen. This concept here that we built it on is, I don't know if anyone's ever filed their taxes, but if you ever file your taxes with Tax Act or whatever, I'm sorry, that's not good. I should have said filed your own taxes, right, and didn't use an accountant. When you go through...
If not, Aaron Biner would like to have an executive session tonight.
When you think about using Tax Act or any of those, if you've ever used it, it's kind of a step-by-step guide. Here's the first thing. I need your personal information. Now I need your W-2 information. And then at the end, or even when you get through each of those slides, it'll tell you, hey, we've got a problem here. Something doesn't seem right. And that's what this system now will take you through. So they're going to go through these various steps to see, is this information correct? Yep. And then you'll see kind of the green check marks up top there. If there's something that's not right, it'll be a yellow kind of cautionary sign that says, hey, there's something here you need to go look at because it doesn't seem like it's jiving correctly. And that's kind of the user experience that we have there. And they can report their bugs down there in the right-hand corner in red. If there's any issues, it'll go directly to IT, and they can, live get a person to try to help them with that system. Our back-end staff can also go into where they're having trouble and link directly to what the issues might be and see exactly what they're seeing to try to help problem solve as well. So that really is the piece of the next-gen IDMS. We thank you for giving us the ability to get it. We're a long way of where we want to be. We're still working with Microsoft, and we're gonna get it right eventually. And you know, to all of the applicants that are out there, I don't know if anyone are listening. We've listened to what you've asked for. We're gonna have the ability to upload job reports, whereas before they had to enter it directly in the system. We'll have a template that they can upload. So you know, we're gonna try to do the best we can, but at the same time, understand that making sure the state's getting what it bargained for. So happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Anyone on the phone? Great. All right, Mike, good afternoon. You're in.
That's good.
That's performance-based stuff. Like all the tax credit programs.
Years, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. All right, let's move. We're going to move forward. So as I think everyone knows, we, a couple of meetings ago, we've instituted committee reports. Between the board meetings, a lot of work gets done at committee between staff and members of the board to prepare for bringing the various items to the board for approval. So I'm going to quickly give you a report on the policy committee. The policy committee met on January 26th with a full agenda. The committee began with presentations on several MOUs and agreements for the board's consideration, including MOUs in support of workforce development and economic development activities in connection with offshore wind-related projects. The committee was provided with three memos for consideration from the community development team, which will be discussed today. Number one is a presentation on a proposed new program, the Main Street Acquisition Support Grant. The second is the award and declination of activation, revitalization and transformation, or ART, real estate grants, one of which I'll be recusing from one item on that. And then the third is the New Jersey Asset Activation Planning Grant, which will be a declination. This was followed by an amendment to the Commuter and Transit Bus Private Carrier Relief and Jobs Program. And then under the Economic Security category, the committee was presented with a proposal for the Food Desert Relief Tax Credit Sale for 2024, followed by the proposal for the creation of Phase 2 of the Child Care Facilities Improvement Pilot Program. And so now we're going to move into the items. The first is under community development, the Main Street Acquisition Support Grant, and Christina Fuentes is going to present.
Thanks. This action item is requesting approval for the creation of the Main Street Acquisition Support Grant. This will be a pilot grant product funded through the Main Street Recovery Fund established through the Economic Recovery Act.
Can I interrupt you for 1 second?
Sure.
For board members who may not have been at a board meeting recently, we now have these slides, which will give you a quick summary of the item that we're going to discuss.
Yes. It will offer a grant for up to $50,000 to reimburse an eligible New Jersey small business closing costs after they have purchased an existing New Jersey commercial property in which they will operate their small business out of. The Main Street Acquisition Support Grant will be available only to small businesses after a real estate closing has taken place. The closing must occur after the application for this product is made available to the public, and the application for the grant must be made no later than 1 year after the closing to be eligible. This product will utilize $5 million with the CEO delegation to increase total grant funding up to $10 million based on demand, plus up to $500,000 to support the authority's 5% administrative cost for this product and a potential $500,000 to hire temporary staff if needed. We're also seeking CEO delegation to approve eligible applications for this product in accordance with the terms in this memo and attached program specs as well. Eligible applicants for this grant, which can be for-profit, nonprofit entities, must also meet all the other eligibility criteria as identified in your board memo and program specs, and also the loan must also be an arm's length transaction with a conventional lender. The grant amount will be determined by utilizing satisfactory closing statements to identify all the closing costs associated to the loan. The grant will be based off the closing costs paid minus the purchase price of the building, business, or any other payoffs. Applications will be accepted on a rolling basis and will be open until all the funds are awarded. Grant awards are capped at $50,000 and will be fully dispersed after execution of the grant agreement. There will be a $500 approval fee that will be due at time of approval as well, too. Happy to take. I know your memo has a lot more detail in that, but happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Christina. Yes. There's always one bit of framing here. This is a long-standing challenge for small businesses, not just New Jersey, but across the country, presumably the world, being at the mercy of landlords who sometimes increase their rent, and you know the proverbial mom and pop has to close their doors because the rent went up, and for whatever reason, good reasons, bad reasons, whatever. And some people like renting. Some people like leasing because they have the flexibility. They want to move. They want to grow. All good. Cool. Some people would like to own their space, and not every business has the resources to fully cover the cost of doing that, particularly minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, veteran-owned businesses, LGBT-owned businesses, immigrant-owned businesses, what have you. And so this is an attempt to put a thumb on the scale for that and see if this works. This is a pilot program. This is a very pilot-y pilot program because we're not, you know, this has been a long-standing, multi-generational, multi-jurisdictional challenge. We're giving it a shot and seeing how we do. But this is one where I think we're pretty excited to see how it plays out and see if there's uptake and if it actually helps, people get site control of their own buildings and control their own destiny in a different kind of way.
And it's a cap of 50,000 per application.
And may I ask, is this done anywhere else? I know it's a pilot program, so are we the first in the country?
Yeah, I've done a lot of research to try to see if I could steal some other ideas.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
You know, there's other entities that will support your closing costs, but if you don't close, it converts to a loan. Us as a governmental entity, it makes it hard for us to get you to a closing because it puts us in a, I don't want to hold up somebody's closing, and also I don't want to put somebody in a property that they can't potentially afford either. So in this case, you've went through a traditional underwriting process. We know that you've afforded this property. You're good to go. And then we're just kind of giving you a nice liquidity infusion to help get you up and running. Yeah. Yeah. So we're taking this approach instead. But, yeah, there's really no – from what I've seen, exactly. So, and we also have the Main Street Recovery Fund statute and rules that we have to follow the guidance for as well, too. So the grant has to go to the small business for that. So we're going to see how this goes. And knowing that there's real estate holding companies tied to this as well, you know, per my lawyer's guidance, we're going to go this route. And if I have to come back and tweak it, we'll tweak it.
Diversity and inclusion portion of this report notes that we are anticipating a disparity study to be done for minority businesses. So we know when that disparity study will be completed.
So we are, so if folks know that the statewide disparity study was released last week that covers procurement, we are currently going, we're now at the end stages of creating what we need to do for EDA products and services. So that is going to have to be a separate disparity study. We're in the process of, you know, trying to get that statement work out now. So that's coming.
All of which is complicated by the rather unfortunate Supreme Court decision that you talked about back in June or whatever that was around affirmative action, broadly speaking, which didn't specifically implicate kind of set aside small businesses, but it certainly cast a pretty long shadow, over all those things.
And that was also in the legislation as well, too, the language that you're referencing. But that's why we always keep the 40% there, just to help encourage that. So the funding would be there.
I know it's one grant per EIN, just in one eligible location.
Yeah.
EIN is not tied to individuals. Can the same owner have multiple businesses and get five different grants?
Yeah, so this is part of the complication nature of this because knowing that we're going to have small businesses, so we would look to the applicant as a small business. That's the EIN we would reference for that application. So that's why we said one per eligible location to just keep it a little tight in that regard. And it's only $5 million. So, but, yeah, that's how it would be tied to the small business EIN. Yeah.
Any other comments, questions, anyone on the phone?
If the MOCO is favorably, it goes in the queue of all the things we have to launch, I think, spring, early summer.
Whatever you say.
spring, early summer. So.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you. A second?
I'll
give a second. Thank you. Any further discussion? Good hearing none, let me call for a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Good hearing none, the program is approved. Good luck.
Thanks.
Okay, next we're going to move to this is the Award of Declination of Activation, Revitalization, and Transformation, or ART, real estate grants.
out of an abundance of caution, in order to avoid the appearance of any conflict, I'm going to recuse myself from this as a New Jersey PAC real estate development, which will be discussed later, involves an investment from Goldman Sachs, which is my former employer and where I am still a shareholder. So I have asked Ginny Bauer to lead the board through the next vote.
Sure. Thank you. Happy to do that. Thank you very much. As our chairman said, we are going to hear from Matt Boyle, who will give us his decision to approve the subject of availability for funding for a grant award to Atlantic City Real Estate Project. So thank you, Matt.
Thanks. This is the request for the award and declination of our real estate grant program applications and request for allocation of additional funds for awardees. Just a little background, the ARP program was approved at the October 2022 board meeting. The goal of the program was to partner with local entities to proactively address the negative impacts of the pandemic and focus on two cities, Newark and Atlantic City. The program accepted applications during the summer of 2023. Of the 24 real estate applications that were received for the program, 22 applications were moved to scoring committee for review, 8 Atlantic City applications and 14 Newark. One Newark real estate applicant withdrew their application after scoring was complete due to material changes of the project after the time of application. The program was originally capitalized with $3.5 million per city focused on real estate projects for a total of $7 million. Additional funds from the Urban Investment Fund in the approximate amount of $11.8 million and Atlantic City initiatives in the approximate amount of $6.3 million is being requested to be allocated to the ARP program due to the volume of projects that apply. The total amount of awards that will be allocated to ARP real estate applicants in Atlantic City is approximately $9.8 million, and in Newark, it's approximately $15.3 million, which is the balance of funds available. All awardees are being approved for the grant amount requested in their application, except one, whose approved award is $500 less than the amount requested. 5 Atlantic City and 8 Newark projects are requested for award based on scoring. The memo contains the description of each of these projects. 3 Atlantic City and 5 Newark projects are being recommended for declination based on scoring. Any questions?
This is some really cool projects. We won't go through all of them, but there's some really cool projects in both AC and Newark that excited to put a shoulder into, and I think your concurrence to put a shoulder into, because there's some really cool things that are proposed here.
And did you mention that one program was approved but just less money? Is that correct? Did I understand that correctly?
It was originally capitalized with $7 million, $3.5 million per city, and then part of the memo is requesting $11.8 million be moved for Newark projects from the Urban Investment Fund and 6.3 for Atlantic City from AC initiatives. So
these are all federal funds. So this is a pretty doable swapping around those funds.
Okay, thank you.
But everyone who's getting an award is getting the amount they requested.
Right.
Okay.
Well, except one applicant is $500 less.
I thought I heard that. May I get a motion to approve this item, please?
So moved, Angela.
Thank you. A second, please.
And
okay. Any further discussion? Any abstentions? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion approved. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Sure.
Now we're going to move to economic security. Riley Edwards on the Food Desert Relief Tax Credit Sale.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Members of the board, before you today is a request to sell up to $35 million of tax credits, corporate business tax credits, and insurance premiums tax credits under the Food Desert Relief Act in 2024. The Economic Security team did our first Food Desert Relief Tax Credit auction in 2023. In the spring, the board approved selling up to $50 million in 2023. We engaged with the market and set an initial amount available for the auction of $10 million when we announced the auction launching. We got more demand than we expected. We're able to increase the amount available up to $15 million, and by the time the auction closed, we had more than $20 million in requests. So we were oversubscribed. We sold all $15 million for a total of more than $13 million in proceeds, which is an average price of about 87 cents on the dollar. The minimum price in the program is 85 cents. Because of the success of this program and because there's certainly more demand for food security programs to support food desert communities, then $13 million will solve. We are back asking to do another auction in 2024. We will also be coming to the board in the coming months with proposed programs funded with the funds from the 2023 auction. The $35 million is the balance of the $50 million that was approved in 2023, which was specific to 2023, so we need your approval to use it in 2024, minus the $15 million that was sold in 2023. In addition, we're also requesting delegated authority for appeals. The eligibility in this program is very black and white, non-discretionary, and it's appropriate for a delegated appeal process, which will keep things running smoothly and quickly. Happy to take any questions.
Is there a cap on, so the 35 is the balance of what's left over from the 50.
Yes.
Is there a cap on, what governs the 50, or could we sell more in 2024?
We could. Help me out. Is it 50 or 60 years, the total program?
So it's $60 million a year for $240 million total over 6 years.
Food Desert Relief Act.
Tax credits, yes.
That includes tax credits that we'll use as tax credits. And then it actually gives us, we could in theory do 240 for the auctions. Got prudent for any of a number of reasons, but it is at this board's discretion how to allocate that 240 across the tax credits and the tax credit options.
Might you
how many years is that? I'm sorry.
That's across six.
6 years. It's through the end of fiscal 2027.
Part of the economic recovery.
Might you come to us for more later in the year?
I'd be surprised. I mean, I would never say never.
Okay.
We will hopefully start seeing some demand on the tax credit side of the equation as well. Right now, this is the only thing tapping into the desert pot.
We launched the tax credit program in December, so still pretty new and waiting for applications there.
Great. Any questions? Anyone on the phone questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion approved.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'm going to call for a vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
I believe today is Riley's birthday. Okay. I'm just giving her $35 million birthday
present. Not personally.
Not personally, just to be clear for anyone listening. Keeping score at
all right.
Home.
The next is...
Boy, things are going well.
Yeah, exactly.
Child care facilities improvement pilot program. Alexander Himmel. And again, we have a slide on this as well.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm very happy to be here this morning to request the approval for the creation of the Child Care Facilities Program Phase 2, as well as a small amendment to Phase 1. The demand for Phase 1 of this program has been more than we've expected. We received 749 applications for a total of $151 million in funding requests, which includes that 15% cost overrun. To date, we've approved 134 applications for over $27 million in requests, including that cost overrun. The amendment for Phase 1 is a request that should Congress extend the deadlines for obligating and expending this funding, the federal funding, ARP, SLFRF, that those extensions will flow down to the grantees. The current deadline for project completion is December 31st, 2026, so without this amendment, the grantees may be tied to that existing deadline. The second item is about the creation of Phase 2. New Jersey, like many other states, has a child care mixed delivery system, which includes center-based providers, which are currently supported by Phase 1, and family child care homes, also referred to as FCCs. A mixed delivery system gives parents a choice of the kind of setting in which they want their children to grow and thrive. FCCs are caring for children in their homes. They're community-based, culturally diverse, and often provide non-traditional hours for families. A majority of the children in FCCs are infants and toddlers. There are designated spaces in the home that are used for the care of children, like the living room, the dining room, the kitchen, a bathroom, and even the outdoor space. These programs often cook snacks, do meals for the children, may also do laundry. Phase 2 of the Facilities Improvement Program will use $5 million from the fiscal year 23 state funding, and 40% of the funds will be set aside for Opportunity Zone eligible census tracts, as we've also done in Phase 1. The program will be open to registered family child care providers, which have a maximum capacity of 5 children. There are about 1,300 registered FCCs in New Jersey, but registration is optional. Applicants must either currently enroll or have enrolled in the last 12 months at least one child receiving assistance from the Child Care Assistance Subsidy Program. They must also offer full-time care, so a minimum of 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 10 months a year. If they're not already participating in Grow NJ Kids, which is New Jersey's quality rating and improvement system, they must commit to doing so within a year of executing their grant agreement. They also need to commit to continue serving children and operating for 2 years following the execution of a grant agreement. The grant awards themselves will be between $10,000 and $20,000 for furniture, fixtures, and equipment only, and the items must fall into one of two categories: health, safety, and accessibility, which would include items such as fire extinguishers, replacing broken furniture, appliances for the use of children. Strike that from the record. The care of children. There are often items that are necessary for these programs to stay compliant with the regulations set forth by the Department of Children and Families. Uses included in the quality environment must be things like cribs, classroom materials with a lifespan of 3 years, or gross motor equipment for the outdoor spaces. These items will support children's learning, growth, and development, and are likely tied to the Family Child Care Environmental Rating Scale, which is an evidence-based assessment tool that's used to determine Grow NJ Kids ratings. FCCs are working with an even smaller profit margin than the centers, and in some cases with none. Knowing this, of our applicant pool, we plan to disperse the first 50% of the grant at the time of closing. The grantees will purchase their materials, and then once they return proof of purchases that have been reviewed by EDA staff, then the remaining 50% will be dispersed to the grantee to finish purchasing their materials and go through a similar review process of proof of purchase. Thank you for your time, and we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Great job. I'm Andrea, as always. Child care program has been just an incredibly important, impactful and important program in lots of different regards. The sort of home-based centers, home-based care is both the right thing to do and I think a virtuous thing to do. It's also required by the legislation that gave us this funding that we carve a portion of it out and use it for these types of centers. I would also note there's, virtually no construction.
There's no construction.
This is not a construction program. We're not putting a roof on somebody's house. We're not putting a construction. And therefore, things like prevailing wage, which is an incredibly important part of what we do all the time, isn't applicable here. This is buying cribs and equipment. This is furniture, fixtures, and equipment.
Are these located throughout the state? Is there regional?
Across the state, representing all counties.
Thank you. Great presentation. The FCCs, I know that they don't have to register with DCF, but for this program, they have to register to be eligible.
Yes.
Then the other parts of this about offering care 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, 10 months a year, have at least one person, one child who's in
the subsidy program. Yes.
So are those things that you will need to monitor? Or are those things that are part of the registration with DCS?
They are things that we'll need to monitor. And they're similar requirements that we have in the existing program, so we have the systems systems to do that monitoring.
You can come back to one thing. The first phase of the program had demand for $151 million.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we've dispersed or approved 27.
Yes.
And do we have more capacity, or is it done at this point?
No. We currently have about $110 million for phase one, minus just $5 million. And Tim is working diligently to try to fill the gap and make sure that we can get as many of those 749 approved.
Yeah, we're no longer taking new applications. Those closed
no.
in, I want to say, September?
October.
October, thank you.
And are those 749 all FCCs?
Yes. The 749 are all center-based.
Center-based,
got it.
Yeah. What you would think of as a daycare center.
Got it. So this is a subset of that?
Correct.
Yes. Okay. Home-based, we're not eligible for the first round,
right.
Much to their favor. So that was my favorite decision. Okay.
Any further questions? Anyone on the phone with questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it, Jenny Bauer.
Thank you, Jenny. A second?
Second, Farrar.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Great.
Good. Thank you.
Good. Great program. The next on MOUs and agreements, Mary Maples on the MOU with the New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development for funding from the Workforce Development Partnership Fund.
Good morning, members. Pleasure to be with you today. Actually, consistent with Tim's comments and Chairman your comments and Commissioner Angela's comments this morning about EDA and our mission over the last 6 years for high-quality job creation, this is an MOU that will enable us to continue that work. Under this request, we are seeking your approval to enter into a 5-year memorandum of agreement with the New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development to accept up to $20 million in funding from the Workforce Development Partnership Fund, which will support the design and execution of workforce development programs and related projects, as well as delegated authority to accept up to an additional $50 million of WDPF funding in the future should the need arise and the funding be available. As a bit of background, the Workforce Development Partnership Fund is a restricted, non-lapsing revolving fund managed by the Treasurer for use by the Department of Labor for specific statutory purposes. And so in collaborating with EDA, DOL and EDA will continue to partner together to design and create programs and projects for the use of these funds over the next 5 years. Key terms of the MOU, in addition to accepting the $20 million, we have also built in a process whereby we will ensure that we seek the Commissioner's approval before coming back either to the board or to Tim under delegated authority for approval of those programs. So today is simply your approval to accept the $20 million and also delegate the ability to accept up to an additional $50 million in the future, but those actual projects and programs will be coming back to the board subject to our existing delegation authority. And so, it's fairly straightforward. I'm happy to take any questions or talk further. And Commissioner, certainly if there's anything you'd like to add from your department, that'd be fine too.
My first question is, should I be able to vote on this, Gabe? I don't know.
I hope you do.
You just don't want to?
Yeah.
You could have called me.
I want to say thanks to EJ and JEDA leadership and staff for getting this done. There's been a lot of conversations back and forth. Just real quick, and this is something that I've been so proud of our work with the EDA over many my time here, but all many projects. We have a fund at the Department of Labor. It's about supporting workforce and training, and there's nothing more important than that dynamic, quite frankly, than working with employers. This is a perfect use of those funds, and that's why our partnership is usually about, because the better touch with employers that we don't may not have in the department. I also give a shout out to my our Deputy Commissioner Hugh Bailey, who passed at the end of last year. This is a huge favorite project of his. Some of the projects we announced in November, along with Tim, about hopefully funding being used to support the expansion of training facilities, apprenticeship training facilities. We're talking about expanding capacity, being where we can't be, expanding our reach. And this goes right along with that, because Hugh realized that we can't have strong foundations for our families, lifelong careers, community-supported wages if the employers are on the table with us. So that's why he's always jazzed about our partnership with EDA, particularly Tara and everybody else here, whether it be working on Jobs NJ many years ago right in this room, like a bunch of college kids eating candy over the weekend. So this is, in my mind, this is part of his legacy. We're very blessed in public service that we get to honor our coworkers from the past, the work that we do every day, and this is a perfect embodiment of that. I'm really excited about the different projects we're going to be doing with this funding that will all come separately before the board over time. But thank you, Mary, Tara, and Tim, and everybody else who worked on putting this together.
Any comments, questions?
Sounds great.
Okay, hearing none, going to hear a motion to approve.
Thank
you, Jewel. Second?
Second, Cruz.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, let me call for a vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Mary. Next, Jen Becker on the Wind Institute for Innovation and Training grant agreement between the NJEDA and the Department of the Treasury.
Good morning. The members are asked to approve a second grant agreement between EDA and the New Jersey Department of the Treasury. In New Jersey's fiscal year 24 budget, $5 million was appropriated as grant and aid to the EDA for the Wind Institute for Innovation and Training. The EDA board approved entering into a similar first grant agreement for $5 million appropriated in the FY23 state budget. This second grant agreement will provide $5 million in funding to support EDA's costs associated with administering and operating programs associated with the Wind Institute for Innovation and Training. All funds must be encumbered by June 2024 and expended by June 2025, and EDA will submit a final report by July 31st, 2025.
This is another one we're doing the intake. We'll be back for the output when the time is right.
Any comments? Questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Okay, motion to approve.
Thank you. Second?
I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, could I call for a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you. Wilson, on the MOU with Salem County to support NJWP, Wincourt, I assume that
Wincourt,
is, related economic development. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the board. Thank you for your time. The infrastructure team would like to request for the board's approval of the authority entering into an MOU with Salem County. This MOU, the proposed MOU, will provide $100,000 in 2024 funding to help the county's economic development efforts stemming from the New Jersey One Board. We would also like to request delegated authority for the Chief Executive Officer, Tim, to approve the potential extension of this MOU for a second and third year. As drafted, the MOU would allow for 2 1-year extensions, each extension for an additional $100,000 in funding, an annual funding, for a potential total commitment of 3 years and a potential total cost of $300,000. The extensions would be pending mutual assent between the two parties, and the authority's monitoring of the county's use of the funds through annual operating plans, budget reports, and end-of-the-year actuals. The authority requires that the county provide matching funds, and for the funds to be limited in use to the operating costs of the county's Office of Economic Development. This MOU would further the authority's partnership with the county and the authority's commitment in the economic development of the county due to the New Jersey Wind Board. The current MOU is to help support the Economic Development Office's proposed initiatives, which include marketing campaigns, creation of an online business directory, and organizing tours and forums which showcase the county's development opportunities. For these reasons, we would like to request for the board's approval of entering into this MOU and for the CEO's delegated authorities. Thank you for your time this morning, and I'm happy to take any questions, although I hope there are none.
This could potentially be a $300,000 commitment. $100,000 plus multi-year.
But it's matching, right? Did you mention that?
Yes, they would have
so
to provide
matching
funds.
Game,
yes.
Right?
One observation now that, when we started on the journey on the wind port, which began in earnest in 19, really into 20, we made a commitment, the governor made a commitment, that we were going to be great partners, not just to Lower Alleys Creek, which is the host community, but to Salem County, which is the host county, not just because that's the right thing to do, but also because the hope is that the wind port is going to have this catalytic effect on a part of the state, in particular, and a city like Salem City nearby that really could use a shot in the arm. Salem County holds 65,000 people. It's the second poorest county in New Jersey. This is, despite the challenges we've had and the setbacks we've had in the last couple of months, this is a game changer for Salem County to have this most appropriate and prudent making in the grand scheme of things, modest investment in making sure the county has the capacity to support those efforts as well.
Good deal.
Any questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, could I call for a motion to approve?
I'll move it, Jenny Bell.
Thank you. Second?
Antoine
Johnson. Thank you, Jewel. Any further discussions? Okay, hearing none, could I call for a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Wilson.
Thank you.
Olivia Barone on the Commuter and Transit Bus Private Carrier Relief and Jobs Program, Phase 2.
Before you jump in there.
Yep, go for it.
This is admittedly a bit of an odd item. It's a reboot, mulligan, whatever your metaphor is, from something we brought back to the board in the fall. This is to support private carriers, buses, that do support NJ Transit's bus network for any of a variety of reasons. I'll spare the details of that. NJ Transit can't manage this funding. It has to be managed by somebody else. We are the somebody else. This was in the state budget two years in a row, in fact, second. That's why it's called Phase 2. We had brought you a methodology that we thought made sense. I still think it makes sense, but it's a matter of opinion. The industry association that represents everyone who's impacted by this, as well as the legislative sponsor of the funding, all sort of unanimously said, you didn't quite get it. This isn't helping the way we hoped it was going to help. Now, if we had done a program for, let's say, restaurants, and Burger King called up and said, this doesn't work for us, you got to change it, you might say, well, that's interesting, but it's a big world, and okay. This is pretty much everybody who's impacted by the program speaking in one voice saying, this isn't really helping the way it was supposed to help, and again, the legislative sponsor, Senator Dugan, sent us a letter saying, couldn't be more gentlemanly and nicer, but you kind of didn't get it right. Could you adjust what you're doing here and go back to the way you did it in the first phase? So that is what we are proposing to do, Olivia, who this is a labor of love. I'm not sure you love the labor of love every day.
Yeah.
But,
So let me just skip through the first 12 paragraphs. So Tim summed it up perfectly. The first board memo, which you guys approved in November of 2023, originally allocated awards to eligible applicants based on a flat award of $1 million, which would have been capped at an applicant's unmet need. And the proposed amendment we have here is to allocate funds based on each eligible applicant's proportional share of the total vehicle revenue miles in New Jersey for 2022, which is publicly available information, and the grant would still be capped at the applicant's unmet need to prevent any windfall. And then any excess funds would be reallocated to the pool and dispersed to eligible other eligible applicants based on their vehicle revenue miles. And then the two letters of support are in the award packet as well.
And is this the formula that was in the first phase?
A little different, but for the most part, we did award applicants in the first phase based off of the proportional miles. Yeah.
So instead of, just giving everybody a flat fee, it's being more customized. Is that
right? Based on service.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if an applicant had,
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually capped. There's not a windfall here. It's capped at
their unmet needs, which we define as the 2022 New Jersey revenue loss, which we would take their 2019 revenue loss, pre-pandemic, pre-remote work, and compare it to their 2022 revenues. And that difference would be their potential award amount.
That's all contemplated by the legislation.
That level of detail is not, candidly,
generally speaking, in our COVID program, that sort of unmet need methodology is pretty standard across how we thought about if you owned a bar in 2019, you made $1 million, and it went to $200,000, we couldn't ever give you more than $800,000.
Yep.
And if you own a bar,
if you can
invite us over, yeah, please let us know. I'm sure we'll be hospitable.
So there were no disbursements in phase two?
We never made open the application. It didn't take long for the feedback.
And then I can just end with all other aspects of the program do and will remain the same. So this is the only really adjustment we're making.
Any questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve?
Motion approved.
Thank you. Second?
Second.
Thank you, Phil. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, could I proceed to a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. Thank you, Olivia.
Thank you.
I give a shout-out to Board Member Cruz and Jamira from GAO as well for helping us navigate that stakeholder engagement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Navigational assistance.
Okay, next we're going to do another committee report. Ginny will give a report on the Incentives Committee meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, the Incentives Committee met on January 24th, and we the staff presented a very exciting Aspire application for approval of relating to New Jersey Performing Arts Center in Newark. And we also have, several items, yes, for the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program.
Great. Thank you, Ginny.
Sure.
Again, as I mentioned earlier, with out of abundance of caution, in order to avoid the appearance of conflict, I'm recusing from this item. As Goldman Sachs, which was my prior employer and where I am still a shareholder, is a potential investor in the New Jersey PAC project. So Ginny will, if you could please lead us through the next item.
Happy to. Kevin, will you please present this Aspire program to us and entertain any questions?
So we are seeking your approval to award up to $199,690,465 in Aspire tax credits to a transformative mixed-use residential project. The project is located in downtown Newark in the area surrounding the existing New Jersey Performing Arts Center, or NJPAC, and is known as NJPAC District. You can take a look. There's some renderings here. I'll give you a description of the project, and then I'll talk a little bit more about the renderings. The applicant is proposing a nearly 580,000-square-foot mixed-use development that will connect the existing NJPAC location with a larger Newark community, serving as a touch point between the city center and the new Riverfront Park through significant investment in public space, in addition to the mixed-use real estate development. The project will include a residential component known as Artside, including 350 units and an additional 10,500 square feet of office space for the Newark-based public radio station WBGO's new headquarters, as well as 12,600 square feet of retail space. The project will also include a new 53,000 square foot arts, education, and community facility known as the Cooperman Center, coupled with the renovation of an existing 17,000 square foot Episcopal Church building for related arts education activities, improvements to the existing 100,000-square-foot NJPAC facility, as well as significant infrastructure improvements to the larger site needed to accommodate development, such as the complete overhaul of NJPAC's front lawn, known as Chambers Plaza. So if you look at the rendering, I think on the left is the best place to start. So you can see in the foreground is the existing NJPAC facility, and that's the Performing Arts Center. And then there is a kind of mid-rise building and then a high-rise building immediately in front of that. That is what we're calling Artside, and that's the residential component. And then you can kind of see on the back side of the high-rise, there's a couple like low-rise roof lines, and those are the townhomes. So they're kind of tucked in behind the two structures. And then across the street, you will see this kind of like curved, rust-colored building. That's the Cooperman Center, and then the Episcopal Church building is kind of immediately behind that, right? So that's, if we look at this rendering in the middle, that's kind of what the Cooperman Center is going to look like. And then on the right-hand side, that is kind of the street view of the art side. So that's the mid-rise building in the foreground, and the high-rise is the other piece of that.
Yeah, I know we probably talked about this in committee, but What's the deal with the Episcopal Church? Are they renovating? Are they using the church? Is it staying it is?
So that building is actually like offices for a current nonprofit that will move out, and then they will, then NJPAC will come in. They're not going to close on that building until the end of.
But it's not currently a church.
No, it's just a building owned by the Episcopal Church that's currently rented to, I think it's some, I don't know the name of the nonprofit, but there's an existing nonprofit in there. They're going to move out.
The
church is actually across the street.
Right.
Oh, the church, yeah, oh, this is just property owned by the church.
Right, if you can see across from that, that's where the church is.
I'm sure some time ago it was the Episcopal Church building, but as
curious.
They have a vibrant soup kitchen in that area, in that church, and it's
oh, nice.
So active.
Good. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
But it is, it's just good. They're going to renovate it, and then they're going to use it for, so there's going to be potentially office spaces, but it's going to be mostly just for arts education program. And a lot of that is like, we can talk a lot about, the project's very complicated. My remarks are going to be very complicated. I've tried to make them as simple as possible, but there's a lot of, they're creating kind of this neighborhood around NJPAC, so a lot of things have to happen to allow for them to build this dense residential piece, and a lot of that is, they're going to cut the back half off of an existing building. That's really what causes the need for the Cooperman Center and this Episcopal Church building, because all of that space is kind of gone and they have to move it somewhere else. Additionally, they basically have to take the NJPAC loading docks and move them to the other side of the building, because they have to put an access road, like just like a regular street road in there. So there's just a ton of kind of like moving parts that are all really, costs get exacerbated because you need to do all these things to allow for this very dense development. All right, so the board memo provides more details, including the unit size and mix of the residential components, the various uses in these non-residential components of the project, instances of past and prospective and NJEDA financial support to NJPAC that are not included in this recommendation, and how the project qualifies as a transformative mixed-use residential project. The art side component, so that's the residential piece, will be owned in combination by two urban renewal entities, with one urban renewal entity owning the mixed-use multifamily component, as well as the associated infrastructure improvements, and a separate URE owning the rental townhomes. CSO Holdco LLC will be the sole member of each of these entities. Okay, so now, NJPAC TSD1 LLC with an 80% interest, and Artside Managers LLC with a 20% interest represent the ownership of CSO Holdco LLC, with Artside Managers LLC and NJPAC TSD1 LLC being co-managing members. NJPAC TSD1 LLC is wholly owned by NJPAC, so that is how NJPAC is kind of the person in control, and they have this 80% ownership. LMXD OZ Investor LLC is a 90% co-managing member of Artside Managers LLC and is controlled by the lead development entity, LMXD, while Mulberry Center Partners LLC is the other 10% co-managing member of Artside Managers LLC and is wholly owned by Serene Morris. Okay, so NJPAC will directly own the existing NJPAC facility in addition to the Episcopal Church building. At the convention of the New Market tax credits used to finance the Cooperman Center, NJPAC will ultimately ground lease the Cooperman Center site to TS2 Development Corporation, a wholly owned subsidiary of NJPAC, which will then sublease these completed, will then sublease the completed Cooperman Center back to NJPAC. Okay, so that is actually simplified from what is in your board now. LMXD is the lead development entity for the project and will be overseeing the development and operations of the residential component of the project. LMXD is a newly formed LNMD Development Partners affiliated company, which is a very prominent multifamily developer, responsible for building transit-oriented, mixed-income, and mixed-use communities in the Northeast and around the country. While not the lead development entity, NJPAC will be performing a variety of functions typical of the lead development entity, such as directing the construction, financing, and ongoing operations of the portion of the project it will directly own. Program rules allow for eligible project costs to be incurred by a previously identified affiliate of the applicant on behalf of the applicant. Site control may also be established on behalf of the applicant by a previously identified affiliate of the applicant.
The memo includes details relating to various affiliates identified by the applicant for these purposes. Many of those affiliates are any number of the entities I've just described. The total development budget is roughly $356 million. To help size the award, we exclude the costs that are prohibited by statute and program rules. The total eligible project costs are $332,817,442, and the memo provides more details on the excluded cost. The developer must contribute at least 20% equity, or in this case, roughly $71.2 million. Equity consists of roughly $53 million of sponsor equity, roughly $19 million of cash, $16,000 of federal grants, or excuse me, $6 million of federal grants, New Market Tax Credit equity of $11.3 million, and LIHTC equity of roughly $5 million, well exceeding the 20% minimum. The sources table in the memo shows there are a variety of funding sources expected in the deal. We subject the applicant's request to the program's various award caps. In this case, the project is eligible to receive the lesser of $60 million of total eligible costs or $40 million on account of being a transformative mixed-use residential project. As such, the project is eligible for an Aspire tax credit not to exceed $199,690,465, which is the lesser of $400 million and 60% of the eligible costs noted previously. To further help size the award, we looked at the project's rate of return. In this case, we used a project-specific hurdle rate provided by EDA's contracted consultant, Jones Lang LaSalle. With the benefit of the Aspire tax credit, the equity IRR is 13.88%, which is below the hurdle rate for comparable developments of 18%. Because this project is receiving low-income housing tax credits, NJHMFA's deferred fee model was also used to measure the appropriate and reasonable rate on return. The developer fee is roughly $10.5 million, with none of this fee deferred to project cash flows. This conforms to the agency's policy, as the total development fee is less than 15% of the total development cost, and the non-deferred fee, or which is the whole fee, is less than the cap on non-deferred fees of 8% of total development costs. So based on the aforementioned factors, we are recommending an Aspire award up to $199,690,465, not to exceed 60% of project costs. 34 cents. Would have been lovely to have that. Oftentimes, the applicant can have the numbers result in a more rounded number, but this was very honest dealers.
One comment. Thank you, Kevin.
Question. Okay. Chairman, you know, I had noted this before, and I'm sorry I didn't bring this up before. I was a former employee of Prudential, and my spouse still works at Prudential, and I also own stocks at Prudential, so I think it's my fault. Maybe I should just do that.
At our December meeting, we had both Riverton and the first phase of the L4 project. This is another one that's been a long time coming, I remember. The first year, when I was still figuring out the restroom board, having a meeting in NJ PAC's office to talk about what became this project. It's morphed quite a bit. This has been a long-standing Newark goal, Essex County goal, NJ PAC goal. So pending your concurrence, this is a big one.
Very cool. Any questions? Not, may I have a motion to move this forward, please?
So moved.
Thank you. Second?
Second, Charlotte.
Any, other than the chairman, any abstentions? Any other questions? If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Congratulations.
Any notes?
Yeah. Any opposition?
Oh, yeah. Any opposition? Forgot. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Ginny. I think I now recuse from my recusal. We're going to return to the agenda. Now we go to film and digital media tax credits. Matt Sestrich.
Morning, Chairman. Good to see the board present today. Speaking of a long time coming, some of this new proposal should be familiar to some folks here, as we did go back in the summer of 22. With a similar proposal that subsequently expired, and the team has been working on this proposal since the recent statutory update, again from last summer. The members are requested to approve the attached special adoption, concurrently proposed rule amendments, and new rules for the New Jersey Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program based on statutory adjustments across the five bills listed in the memo, and authorize staff to A, submit publication in the register, and B, submit the final adopted rules in the New Jersey Register if no comments are received, subject to final review and approval by the Office of the Attorney General and the Office of Administrative Law. As a background on the program, the New Jersey Film Tax Credit Program provides tax credits of 35% of all qualified film production expenses to film productions who meet one of the following eligibility criteria: either 60% of the film's total production expenses, not counting post-production costs, are incurred for services and goods purchased through vendors authorized to business in the state, or the qualified production expenses of the project exceed $1 million in a single tax year. The credit amount is reduced to 30% for expenses incurred for goods and services within a 30-mile radius of Columbus Circle, New York, but also in New Jersey. And the digital media side of the program provides a 30% tax credit for all qualified spend and is available to digital media productions who meet two eligibility criteria, the first being at least $2 million of the total spend is incurred through vendors authorized to do business in the state, and the second, at least 50% of the qualified costs have to be incurred for wages and salaries paid to full-time workers in New Jersey working on digital media projects. Additionally, the digital side has a 5% bonus for all expenses incurred for services performed and tangible personal property purchased through vendors whose primary place of business is in the southern part of the state. Both film and digital, there is a 2% diversity bonus for productions who meet specific hiring goals. This bonus can be increased to 4% for productions who, in addition to meeting the diversity of play goals of the first side, commit to make to make certain commitments to hire New Jersey residents for on-screen roles. As mentioned in the memo, the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program has been amended by five separate bills since the current form of the rules were approved back in June of 2019. The attached proposal includes numerous changes directed by statutory changes newly reflected in this version of the rules. In addition to those legislative changes, there is a number of policy decisions or changes made based on policy decisions during the rule writing process. These policy decisions are highlighted in more detail in the memo, and they include amending existing definitions like film, principal photography, or the definition of vintage year. We created some new definitions as well based on those policy decisions, definitions for deferred compensation, a definition for homeowner, personal residence, as well as the shoot day. Some of the other policy decisions included increasing the diversity bonus threshold. The attached rules include provision increasing the diversity plan hiring goal to 25%, up from the previous 15%. Authority staff, including the DE&I team, felt an increase was appropriate given the number of projects that were coming in for the bonus and getting it, and just to increase it to a level similar to more industry standards, as a lot of productions themselves have standards higher than the 15%. We also set a goal of 25% on the on-screen talent side as well, just to match the previous goal. Because designations for studio partners and film lease partner facilities are limited by the statute to only three per category, staff propose to require projects seeking these designations to be as close as operational as possible, so that someone doesn't sit on the designation with a project that's far off. These projects will be required to either have site plan approval or a redevelopment agreement in place before application, and commit to be able to obtain a TCO for the first 250,000 square feet of the project within 36 months of approval. And instead of annual reporting and ongoing project site monitoring for these studio partner and film lease partner facilities, each subsequent application for tax credit submitted on the basis of those designations, we'll be required to obtain a signed certification from the studio partner or film lease partner facility owner that the designee is still in compliance with the program. Further policy decisions surrounding film lease partner facilities and studio partners is making them subject to award agreements, which ultimately have recapture and penalty provisions. The film lease partner facility and studio partners the award agreement specifically will lay out the requirements to maintain the designations as well as include the recapture provisions. For both designations, any recapture would be limited to only the excess benefit that the projects received on the basis of that designation. This excess benefit can be calculated by the excess award amount received based on this designation that a regular project could not. For film lease partner facilities specifically, they will be subject to recapture provisions allowing the authority to recapture from the facility any excess benefit that any project received on the basis of that facility's designation. So instead of going after the film projects, we're going to go after the facility owner if they are in default of the program requirement within the first 5 years. Studio partners award agreements will include provisions that they commit to occupying the facility for 10 years. Additionally, there will be recapture provisions that allow us to recapture the excess benefits provided to a studio partner if they fail to occupy that facility for the duration of the commitment period, as well as recapture any deferred compensation that was included as part of their award that they fail to prove that they reached. There was a specific policy decision included in this proposal in response to direct concerns raised by members of this board, as well as the subsequent conversations thereafter regarding prevailing wage and how that's impacted on projects that were previously completed before they applied for the program. Unlike our other incentive programs, there's no material factor need, so there are instances where projects are complete before they submit applications. So in this rule proposal, any construction contracts that are entered into by a film project applying for assistance has to comply with all prevailing wage affirmative actions and contractor registration requirements, even if that project was completed prior to approval. Additionally, all construction contracts entered into by a studio partner or film lease partner facility after the effective date of those rules, of these rules, will also need to comply with these requirements. The last kind of policy area that we changed is surrounding fees and the fee schedule. Be more consistent with other programs the authority operates. We modified the film fees from a percentage-based fee scale to a flat fee scale with multiple tiers. The tiers are based on the amount of film production expenses for a given project. And we have also added several other fees to be consistent with other programs, like an approval fee, which we previously did not have. Total fees will range from $1,300 for the smallest productions under $1 million, and as high as $65,000 for projects with over $30 million in qualified spend. We try to keep it consistent, ranging from 1 to 4% of a total fee burden to be consistent with other programs. And the members, again, are requested to approve the attached special adoption, concurrently proposed rule amendments and new rules, and authorize staff to A, submit the publication for the New Jersey Register, and B, submit as final adopted rules in the New Jersey Register if no comments are received, subject again to final review by the Office of the Attorney General and the Office of Administrative Law. Happy to answer any questions on the rule changes.
If I start, I'll take 5 minutes. I think these are all really positive changes, particularly diversity stuff, tightening up, making sure we're crystal clear on prevailing wage again. But just putting up a big clear sign and big bold letters if you want the program. Pay prevailing wage on your project, whether you've applied or not. This is pretty clear.
This is the first set of changes since 2019.
Rule changes.
First, that's hoping to become effective. We had a previous proposal under the previous chairman in the summer of 22. That proposal expired because we learned of statutory changes that were going to drastically impact what we had just proposed. We kind of held off on that, and this is kind of a combo of those changes plus comments that we got during that period, comments that we got during the EO63 process, and then just looking at the new statute.
They go back to public comment again. So
yeah, they do. Oh,
okay. They have immediate effect. So as of if you were to concur with this recommendation, it would have immediate effect whenever they're published in the journal or whatever it's called, basically immediately. And then go back to public comment. Yep.
We can
lots
react
little,
if we
lots little none. I don't know.
Would anticipate comments
sure
received.
It's an industry that has no shortage.
We'll be back in the summer sometime for the final proposal.
Probably by the time we get back,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And this has become a very substantial program for us.
Mm-hmm. Neck and neck with Aspire.
Yep.
The most.
Yeah. Any further comments, questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion to approve the body as presented by Matt?
I'll move it.
Thank you. A second?
Second.
Any further discussions? Hearing none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. Now, next is the certification of unused or unredeemed credits.
Yes. So continuing the film portion today, the members are asked to approve the certification of unused and unredeemed film digital media tax credits from state fiscal year 2023 to increase what's available for this current state fiscal year 2024. We initially planned to do this several months ago, but with the strikes being active, we felt it was best to hold off on most film approvals until those things were concluded. The newest statute, PL 2023, Chapters 97, was the most recent change to the film program, was enacted on July 6, 2023, which amended the Film and Digital Media Program. This statute increased the annual cap available for the studio partner and film lease partner buckets up to $150 million per year from $100, and that starts in state fiscal year 24. So you'll see some further down.
This slide is a really good way to look at, follow this one, right?
Yeah, it's further in, you'll see where we have to steal some money from other programs where it gets a little confusing, which is a change from the several bills ago. The bill this last summer just bumped up the time frame in which we could start reallocating the money. Which is my next line here. The new statute removed the ability for EDA to share at its discretion between buckets, as now each can only be carried forward into itself for the next fiscal year. The new legislation also requires non-discretionary reallocation of $250 million from the Aspire and Emerge program cap into the studio partner bucket, as well as $250 million into the film lease production company allocation bucket. And we had to do that non-discretionary reallocation in 23, 24, and 25. As background, we've done this before the certification process. We did it on February 9th, 2022. The board approved the certification to carry forward for credits in state fiscal year 21. These caps increased the starting point for 22 by over $124.4 million for the legacy film side, $100 million in both studio partner and film lease partner credits, and over $32.4 million in digital media. On September 14th, we did it again, this time for the 23 fiscal year, and the caps were increased for legacy film by over $28.1 million, $200 million for studio partner, and for both studio partner and film lease partner tax credits, and over $54.4 million for digital media. Additionally, at that time, the board approved, we had the ability to transfer between buckets at that point, so we shifted some funds from the film lease partners bucket, which was underutilized at that point, moved it to the legacy film side. So that's where you see kind of a jump up to over $300 million to start off that fiscal year. Also, due to some reporting errors during that time, we had incorrectly included 8 projects in the 2020 approvals that should have been based on date of approval, been included in the 21 approvals, which would have changed the amount that we certified to. Changing it from, in 22, $124 million down to $99.4 million. This also impacted the next year. As we moved down the line, we would have had a little bit less for each fiscal year. So the amount that we should have moved forward to 23 for legacy film should have been $4.2 million, starting off that year with $304.2 million, as you can see from the start. We had 56 approvals in legacy film, which is our fancy term for projects that are not studio partners and not film lease partners. Across those 56 approvals, it was for over $267 million, which left us with $38.8 million, which is what you're certifying to today and allowing us to bring forward next year, which would start the cap for the 24 fiscal year to $138.8 million. On the studio partner side, the allocation cap for 23 started at $300 million. We had no approvals as of yet, and we did reallocate the non-discretionary amount from Aspire and Emerge, which increased it to $550 million, adding in the 24 allocation annual allocation cap of $150 million. We get to a starting 24 allocation cap of $700 million, and then you'll see additional math below, which is the reallocation again for the fiscal year 24, which would then bump that up to $950 million.
So to date, have we made any grants under the studio partner allocation?
No, so we've made a designation approval, but they have not come in for projects yet, as that facility is not.
That's Lions Gate Newark, they have not built the place yet.
Okay. Similar story on the film lease production company side. Starting off the year, we had $100 million with no approvals. We have the $250 million reallocation from Aspire, which brought us to the $350 million. Again, adding in the annual allocation of $150 million brings us to the $500 million number with the additional map showing that we would start off the year with $750 million for that category. So staff is recommending the board approve the certification and carry forward of these amounts to increase what's available for fiscal year 2024, and this request requires just one vote.
I'm sorry, there's a strategy that underpins all these numbers and all the various gives and gets here, which is that over time, we would like to shift the amount of approvals we're doing to the right here, to the studio partners and the film lease production companies, because we want the brick-and-mortar studios. So that's those big buckets of credit that now sit there and will continue to sort of accrue. Is the chum of the water for folks actually build these facilities and create all the permanent jobs and have all the business.
So if you said Lionsgate, would that be Netflix?
Netflix is likely to have, that actually may apply for studio partner designation. We'll consider that when it's ready to be considered. We don't know who the third will be there, and then I think we'll start to see probably one or two film lease production applications in the spring and summer.
Yeah, with the passing of the rules, we'll start developing the applications for those, reopen the studio partner allocations, and we, under the previous rule proposal, it had rules surrounding the studio partner side of the program, which dissolved. So we had no kind of guiding rules, so we took the application down until we had rules.
Again, this is math, right? We're looking at this is just the math of unused and rollover.
Yeah.
But if you build the studios, you're saying longer-term commitment then. If you build those, they're going to come.
Correct, and then they're going to start tapping into the two buckets on the right. One of the two buckets on the right.
And those buckets on the right are only for those projects submitted by those designations, so it's kind of to their own queue, their own funds.
Any further questions, comments? Okay, hearing none, could I have a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Thank you, Jenny. Second?
Second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? All right, thank you. The motion passes. Now, we have two specific projects to approve today, Matt.
Yes. This is under the Film Tax Credit Program. EDA staff has completed the review and recommends the approval of two applications under the Film and Digital Media Tax Credit Program. We've received written confirmation from an outside firm hired to review the production budgets to make sure that they are reasonable for industry standards. All the film content has been reviewed and recommended for approval under the Act by the New Jersey Motion Picture and Television Commission. Total credits utilized across the recommended film approvals is over $57.8 million. The first project under consideration is 20th Century Fox Film Corporation, who's the applicant on both of these projects, but the first one is for American Horror Stories Season 3. This project includes a 2% diversity bonus, and we're recommending an award of just over $25 million. The second application, again, is also for 20th Century Fox Film Corporation, who's responsible for the production of American Sports Story Season 1. This project also has a 2% diversity bonus, and we're recommending an award of just over $32.8 million. Each project does need its own separate vote. Thanks.
Any discussions or questions? All right, so we're going to take two votes.
Yes.
All right, so the first is for American Horror Story Season 3. Could I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Second? Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, could I call for a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Hearing none, the motion passes. The second is for American Sports Story Season 1. A motion to approve. Thank you.
Second.
Thank you, Phil. Any further discussion? Hearing none, call for a vote. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, refusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amount of water and a cliff bar.
They're not very novel with their names, right? American.
Well, they're really the same franchise, actually.
Oh, I see.
It's the same.
If we didn't hear a motion to approve, I was going to offer rolls in the... okay, now authority matters. Jason, on the New Jersey Asset Activation Planning Grant Declination.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the board. The Asset Activation Planning Grant Program has previously been given delegated authority for staff to approve awards and decline awards based on non-discretionary reasons. Therefore, the only application decisions that require board action are declinations for discretionary reasons. And this month, there is one such recommendation. The applications are reviewed on a rolling process based on the order in which they are submitted. They are not competitively scored against each other, but they must meet a minimum score of 65 points out of 100 to demonstrate ability and potential for the proposed planning study to lead to an improved utilization of the public asset. The application currently being recommended for declination is from Land Dimensions Engineering, who requested grant funding of $50,000 to analyze alternative land uses for the former Rowan College at Burlington County campus in Pemberton Township. The 225-acre site within the Pinelands Management Area operated as a county college from 1971 to 2017 and has been mostly vacant since that closure. Some structures on the site have required demolition after experiencing vandalism and fire. The site has been part of or the focus of 10 different studies since 2009, including the EDA's own 21st Century Redevelopment Program. The scoring committee determined that the application received 59.3 out of 100 points, which does not meet the required overall score. The board are therefore requested to decline the grant award.
Any questions?
Jason, can you elaborate where they, if you recall, where they fell short on what criteria? Was it a
sure.
board or any specific?
There were notes from the scoring committee, mostly in the purposes and merits section, which is the viability of the plan to lead to redevelopment of the site. So based on the fact that there were so many plans in the past that have not done so, including our own, that lost some points there.
It's right outside the jurisdiction of this presentation, but what's wrong with the site? I mean, 10 studies, Tim.
Should be in the 11th study. We should, consider approving them.
State, who owns this? The college?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah.
The county, actually. I think the county owns
the county college.
Yeah. Probably worth the conversation.
Thanks.
Take my recommendation.
Steel trip.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? So the motion is to support the declination, correct? All right. So may I hear a motion to approve?
I'll move it.
Second?
Antoine Johnson.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion, which is supporting the declination, signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the declination is approved.
Thank you.
Tim, board memorandum?
Eight. Not seven, but eight. Delegated authority memos in your pack, and we'll go into great detail, but there's a particular amount of detail on community development, a number of programs there, including the Main Street programs, asset activation, which Jason was just presenting about, indoor amusement park program, cannabis, any number of programs that are there. So we've got a good indicator of all that happens in between meetings and not between meetings.
Yes, and I think as everybody knows, one of the things we've been, just as today's example of the amount of items that are brought to the board for approval, we've tried to move towards more delegated authority to Tim on, you know, items that are more regular way, right? So this is a good example of that. Okay, so moving forward, I'm now going to go to the public comment section of the meeting. I'd now like to open the public comment portion of the meeting. First, I'd like to ask Danielle Esser to read the NJEDA's public comment policy and process for this board meeting.
Thank you. As stated in NJEDA's public comment policy, members of the public who wish to speak during the public comment period will be acknowledged to speak first in person, then by phone. Members of the public attending the meeting by phone who are registered or interested in providing comment can press 1-0 on the keypad, which will place them into a queue based on the order of speech. The policy is as follows. Each speaker will be prompted to speak one at a time. Each speaker should announce his or her name, organization affiliation, and the topic on which remarks will be given. Each speaker will have a maximum of 3 minutes and should limit their comments to matters pertaining to the authority. Staff will prompt the speaker once their time has expired, and a speaker may provide comment only once during the same public comment period to ensure there's enough time available for all of those who wish to speak. Related documents, printed comments, or materials may be attached to an email. Thank you.
Okay, I'd now like to acknowledge any members in person who would like to provide public comment at this time. Seeing no one in the room, operator, could you ask for anyone on the phone who'd like to provide public comment?
Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, for members of the public on the phone, if you wish to ask a question, please press 1 and then 0 on your telephone keypad. You may withdraw your question at any time by repeating the 1-0 command. If you are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before pressing the numbers. Once again, if you have a question, you may press 1 and then 0 at this time. We'll go to we'll go to the line of William O'Day. Please state your organization. Your line is now open.
Good morning. William O'Day, Elizabeth Development Company. Actually, I don't have... Hello?
Yeah, we're here. Yeah.
Morning, Bill.
Yeah, hey, William O'Day, Elizabeth Development Company. Good morning. Actually, I don't have a question, although you had so many great things on the agenda. I probably have 20 questions. But my purpose to call in today was just to recognize your executive director, Tim Sullivan. When someone does things in a proactive manner, since government so often is reactive, I think it's important to give kudos and recognize. There was recently a significant fire of a pretty historic or well-known pizza, Santilla's, in the city of Elizabeth on a weekend. And when I walked into my office that Monday morning, there was a email from Tim saying, if there's anything the EDA can do to help that business, please let us know. And they have been engaged with us and with the city of Elizabeth ever since as we try to assist that owner in putting back together the pieces and getting the business reopened here in the city of Elizabeth. So on behalf of Mayor Bullwage and myself, from the EDC, I just wanted to say thank you.
Very nice. Thank you very much, sir, for calling in.
And your team's been a great partner in that, and hopefully we can get them back up and running soon.
Thanks.
Operator, any other comments or questions?
Yes, we'll go to the line of Charlie Cradaville. Please state your organization.
Yes, good morning. Charlie Cradaville, New Brunswick Today. Can you all hear me?
Yes.
Good
morning, Charlie.
Good morning. Please forgive me if I missed any dialogue on this. The personnel matter approving the increase of a salary for chief executive officer. I just wanted to ask the, what it is now and what it will be, and what constraints, if any, there are on that salary. It's not something that was covered by that recent legislation, right?
No, it was not covered by the recent legislation. We're going to address that matter next.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think that's all I had to ask about this morning, so I will listen with great interest, and thank you for hearing me out.
Operator, any other comments or questions?
We have no further in queue. Please continue.
Okay, thank you. There are no additional comments. Now we will go to the item, which is the personnel matter, and the subject is to approve an increase in the chief executive officer's salary. A memo was presented to the board. I'd like to ask for a motion to approve.
So moved, Angela.
Thank you. In a second.
Second.
Happy to do it. Okay, now, before we take a vote, if there are any comments or discussions specific to Tim, we will be holding those under executive session. And I would suggest we move to executive session.
First, if there are any comments or discussions on the other parts of the memo, that can be held now. If not, we can go into executive session.
Okay. I would like to request a motion to enter executive session. Could I have a motion to approve?
So moved, Dumont.
Thank you.
Kemp, go.
Operator, we're now going to enter executive session. For members of the public, you may hold the line, and we will return to the line when executive session has concluded.
Thank you. The board will now enter executive session. For members of the public, you may hold the line. Board members and staff will return to the line.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
No problem.
Have returned to the general session.
So we okay, well, that was the operator saying we're back.
We're back. Okay. Give us 1 second to get the room set.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah. We're back.
Close the door. Can't. Open door meeting.
All right. We have now returned from executive session. I'm now going to request a motion regarding a personnel matter. The CEO's annual salary at the EDA has remained the same at $225,000 since 2012. Despite inflation, significant increases in the cost of living, and the fact that the EDA's net assets have grown from approximately $670 million in 2012 to $1.7 billion at the end of 2023, the CEO's salary has not increased in 12 years. The salary was not increased when, on February 22, 2018, the board voted to appoint Tim Sullivan as CEO, nor has the CEO's salary increased for the past 5 years. On January 16th, the governor signed into a bill increasing the salaries of certain state officials, including cabinet members that head principal departments, which increased cabinet member salaries by 20%. Given the aforementioned reasons, it is the recommendation to increase the salary for the CEO's position for the EDA from $225,000 to $295,000 per year, retroactive to January 1, 2024. May I hear a motion to approve?
We have the motion second. So
sorry. Any further discussion, comments, or questions? Okay, hearing none, could I hear a motion? Should we take a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, recusals, or abstentions? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
If there are no additional comments, I'd love to thank everyone for their participation, and now we'll request a motion to adjourn the meeting. May I hear a motion to adjourn?
I'll move it.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. That concludes our meeting. Operator, thank you. That concludes our conference call.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for your participation and for using AT&T conferencing service. You may now disconnect.
I'm getting cut off tomorrow. I went through 2 years of growing it, and then I got tired. My kids told me the other day, you really look like Albert Einstein.